everything so you can, you know. I do know there's...
Call the House Committee on Health Care to order for...
You know, that routine prescribed.
6th of April.
He's charged a whole lot more.
And open up a public hearing on House Bill 3378. And ask Representative Nancy Nathanson to introduce us. Sandy, what's this bill do?
I think it's because they're purchasing, but it's too small to manage multiple.
Simple bill, Mr. Chair, I believe. House Bill 3378 requires hospitals to adopt written discharge policies, and it specifies the policy requirements.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. Today I'm presenting 3378 to you, known as the CARE Act. CARE stands for Caregiver Advise, Record, and Enable. And the goal of this legislation is to ensure that family caregivers are included as part of the care team when someone is hospitalized. AARP Oregon brought this forward, and I'm supporting it because I feel like it will improve the health of our patients, but also help the family caregivers in Oregon provide the support they need. Family caregivers are the core of our natural support system in Oregon, and they provide over $5.5 billion worth of unpaid care every year. After a loved one is hospitalized, often their family members take on the role of caregiver for the first time, and they're asked to do something that they've never done before and that they never expected to do. This care may take the form of wound care, medication management, physically transferring a person from bed to wheelchair, or other tasks. To do these tasks right, you need the right instruction, or the patient could end up back in the hospital with an infection or a medication reaction, for example. The CARE Act is a bipartisan proposal that will increase the likelihood family caregivers can provide good quality at home. It requires hospitals to adopt policies that will do several things. Identify if a patient has a family caregiver and record the contact information. Notify the caregiver when the patient is to be discharged from the hospital. And finally, provide a demonstration of the care the caregiver is expected to provide to the patient at home. Many hospitals already do much of this, but this bill will ensure that all Oregon hospitals are working to involve family caregivers in the care of the patient. The bill was crafted in negotiations with the hospitals to provide some flexibility and to take into account the acuity level of the patient and the needs of the caregiver. I think the bill turned out well. Mr. Bartholomew from AARP will be able to provide more details, specifics, and answer questions. And I do urge your support for this to improve the ability of our family caregivers to take care of the ones they love. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Representative Nathanson? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask all the witnesses today to be as brief as they possibly can on this and all the bills. We have a pretty big agenda. Would you call the first panel, please?
John Bartholomew, Janet Martinez, and Jessica Adamson.
And the next panel?
And after that, it will be Patty O'Sullivan and Bill Olson.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm the Government Relations Director at AARP Oregon. I'd like to thank the chief sponsors of this legislation, Representative Greenlich and Representative Nathanson, for bringing this before you, and also all the co-sponsors on the dais, too. We're pleased here today to be in support of House Bill 3378, the CARE Act. Now, we support this proposal because we've seen a steady shift in the role of family caregiving over the last few decades. Family caregivers have traditionally done the things such as bathing, dressing, eating, household tasks like shopping and managing finances. And these are very important things, but in recent years, the role of family caregivers has dramatically expanded to include performing medical and nursing tasks of the kind and complexity only found in hospitals. In 2012, we did a report in collaboration with the United Hospital Fund that did a national survey of family caregivers, where we surveyed over 1,600 family caregivers across the country, including in Oregon, to determine what are they doing. We did this report called Home Alone, Family Caregivers Providing Complex Chronic Care. And some of the highlights include that almost half, which is about 46%, of family caregivers perform medical or nursing tasks for care recipients with multiple chronic physical and cognitive conditions. 3 out of 4 family caregivers were managing medications, including administering intravenous fluids and injections. And caregivers found this very stressful. More than a third wanted more training to do all of this. So, most related to this legislation, most family caregivers report that they received little or no training to perform these tasks. So last summer, AARP Oregon performed a survey of over 800 registered voters over the age of 45. We found that half of these folks have already been a family caregiver or are currently providing care to an adult loved one. And of those, 70% are dealing with these complex tasks such as medication management or medical tasks. There are over 460,000 unpaid caregivers in Oregon, providing care valued at over $5.5 billion every year. These are our natural supports. We need to make sure that we support them as best we can if we want to have the independence, choice, and dignity our system is based on. As Representative Nathanson had already noted, that a lot of these folks are thrust into caregiving for the first time. They've never been doing this. They never expected to be doing this. And if they don't have the tools to provide quality care at home, you're going to have patients going back to the hospital with readmissions for a number of different issues, which is expensive to our system as well as bad, of course, for the patient and the families. That's where this bill comes to play. CARE Act, Caregiver, and Advise, Record, and Enable. As you've already heard, this bill requires hospitals to adopt policies so that they will find out if there is a family caregiver, who is it, and record them. 2, notify that caregiver that the patient is being discharged. And 3, make sure that if there's a demonstration that needs to be provided to that family caregiver, good, you know, a certain level of instruction so they can provide quality care at home, they will get that. You know, it's flexible to allow for the hospitals to identify when somebody really doesn't need a lot of training or education about this, but it does make sure that those caregivers have what they need. Being shown how to do something is a lot more effective than being told how to do something. I mean, my personal story, my wife I've had to give her injections. And if I wasn't shown how to give an injection before I had to do it, it probably would have freaked me out. I may have done it wrong. I may have not gotten the drug into her body that I needed to. So being shown how to do something goes a lot further than just being told how to do something. So we at AARP want to thank the representatives from the hospitals for working so collaboratively with us. Compromises were made on both sides in the crafting of this legislation. We know that we have a partner in the hospitals in terms of providing good quality care for patients and reducing readmissions.
Do you have an amendment for it?
There is a -1 amendment that we are supporting that clarifies some of the language, and so we are here testifying in support of that -1 to the bill. So I thank you, and I'd like to turn it over now to Janet Martinez, who can talk about caregiving.
I'm a very tired caregiver. My history is I'm breast cancer. Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Janet Martinez. And as I mentioned, I'm a very tired caregiver.
That's good.
I myself have had breast cancer, and our adopted daughter had brain cancer. So I've been to this rodeo, and my 92-year-old mother lives with us. So I've just been released. She was just released from Providence. And so I've just gone through this experience of recording that I was the caregiver and them notifying me of her discharge. And I have in front of me my paper instructions. that I'm a gerontologist and I'm an advocate. And so the process was pretty easy for me because I could get ahead of the ball. And I kept thinking in the back of my head, if someone wasn't able to navigate, had a language barrier or any kind of cognitive problem, just I have various cousins who wouldn't be able to get through this process and getting their loved one cared for, what would be? And I happened to ask that to one of the PT therapists, and she said, well, we just keep them in another month. And I thought, well, how much is that costing to keep someone in a hospital a month as opposed to sending them home with a qualified caregiver? Someone, all you need is, the first part is a good heart. So I can't speak strongly enough how important these three elements are to this CARE Act. And in terms of, we happen to have a little money. So when these discharge papers, right before they were coming down, I knew I had to go get a walker. I knew I had to go construct our bottom level to make room for a commode. And we had to kind of, my mom lives upstairs from us, and she does not want to go back down. She wants to be in her own space. And so there's another tension. And it's only going to get worse in terms of I'm already toileting and showering and things like that. But there's a whole emotional taxation that I'm exhausted with. And people have it way worse than I do. Like I say, we have a little money that we can throw at this. If I didn't, how would I have gotten that walker that she needed? Because she'd already had another one put in at Medicare. So they weren't going to cover the two front wheels of it. And so we're going to have to pay for the back wheel. It's like, what if we didn't have that money? And just my wife, thank you, Oregon, was able to put in the grab bar so we didn't have to hire out to do that. And we had to do it that night before she was coming home. So, like I say, she's going on 93, and this isn't going to stop. And so the idea of respite, what does that mean? And how, what an evocative and multi-layered question about what that means. So I hope I haven't overstated myself, but thank you for doing all you can on this.
You've done fine. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. We're very pleased today to be here in support of House Bill 3378 and the -1 amendments. This has been a really tremendous process to get here today, and I really want to thank AARP and John Bartholomew in particular for really working hard to figure out how can we improve discharge planning in Oregon. What Providence knows is that discharge planning, when it's done well, is individual to that patient. Not everyone is as informed and as outstanding a caregiver as Ms. Martinez has the experience to do that. So what we try and do, particularly those that are most vulnerable or having pretty dramatic major surgery, what we try and do is really understand where is that patient, what's their situation look like. If you're going to have a hip replaced, it's not just do you have a home and a caregiver to go home to, but what is that front set of steps looking like up to your porch? Are you going to be able to get up those? Do you have the supports in your home? And so those kind of full look at what is good discharge planning, when it's done best, isn't a cookie cutter approach. It's really individual to that patient. So the way this bill is designed really will enable and encourage hospitals to develop policies that really focus on patients. What are the capabilities of their caregiver? Where is their knowledge base? And how can we help move that forward from a range of services? Everything from a hip replacement to a mental health discharge to somebody who's just coming in to have some minor surgery and going home and just needs to make sure that they get that bandage changed and they have a follow-up appointment made. So we're very excited about this bill. Really appreciate the process. Encourage the committee to adopt the -1 amendment and pass this bill along.
And Medicare doesn't pay for readmissions. This is a good way to avoid unnecessary readmissions, isn't it?
absolutely. And in a world of accountable care, especially when we're working on, even in the commercial market, bundled packages, if we don't manage and ensure that our caregivers, as these folks are leaving the hospital, are well prepared, we're at risk for those costs. And so we think that this is absolutely important, something we've been focused on for a long time, but very pleased to support a bill that's going to put an additional focus on this issue.
Are there any questions of the panel?
Just a comment, please.
Yep.
Chair Greenlee, I applaud your efforts. This is really good. Just a comment, though. Good discharge planning starts before admission for major elective surgeries. So I just encourage you to look at that piece of it, too. So training of the family and the patient before they ever admitted really helps.
Mr. Chair, Representative Buehler, we couldn't agree more. When we do joint replacements, there's a whole process of an education, including group classes, that we do to make sure that folks are ready not only to have surgery but to go home and know what that's going to look like. So absolutely couldn't agree more.
Well, thank you very much. Would you call the next panel, please?
Thank you.
Patty Sullivan and Bill Olson.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Patricia O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We have 62 hospitals and health systems in Oregon. And I'm here today to wholeheartedly support the amended bill with the dash ones. I would like to thank AARP and Jonathan. He put up with all of us and our little minor things and word changes and all that. And it was a good process. Health care is changing, and people don't stay in the hospital as long as they used to, and they're going home in a more vulnerable condition sometimes than they used to. Like the one witness said, you know, maybe if you weren't quite ready, you just stay a few more days. Well, that's very, very expensive, and insurance companies don't like that. There's trained caregivers. We've all heard lots of bills in the past 6 years on the home health care workers, and they're pretty well trained, but everybody can't afford it, or they make too much money, but their insurance doesn't pay for it. So this bill approaches it from a family and lay caregiver. Lay caregiver kind of being the key words to this bill. And that's somebody that person is comfortable with. Sometimes it's not family. Sometimes it's a friend or a neighbor. But they get to designate who that is. And then that person is called to talk about the discharge planning and get trained on some of the care if they're going to be the caregiver. And I just think that's really, really important with the more complicated way that people are going home in conditions. We have discharge planning, obviously, but again, people are facing tougher challenges when they go home. We have to comply with CMS regulations, so we have regulations that kind of lay out what we're going to do. This is going to be an adjunct onto those regulations. It's going to give each hospital a framework, but it's flexible enough to be applied to the individual, their caregiver, their family, and their condition. So we wholeheartedly support this. And again, I'll answer any questions, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Chair Greenlick, members of the House Health Committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I've submitted written
your
testimony.
Name,
my name is Bill Olson, I'm sorry, and I'm co-chair of the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities. I'd just like to emphasize a couple of points that haven't been made yet. The other testimony, I think, covered things very well. My personal experience is that my son, who was 21 at the time, suffered a brain injury and a skiing accident in Mammoth Mountain, California. And he was in a coma. The prognosis was uncertain as to whether he would survive or not. But he was in a coma, so we weren't able to talk with him, of course, at that point. I guess the thing I'd really like to emphasize, since 83, I think there's more awareness of traumatic brain injury, probably because it's been designated as a signature injury of the recent wars with Afghanistan and Iraq. And so ideally, there's more knowledge out there. However, the very fact that we're considering this bill suggests that we have more work to do in terms of preparing people to take care of their family members or friends. I can only say that there was not any counseling or any assistance that we were given that I can recall. It's 1983 now that I'm talking about, but I don't recall any counseling or assistance that prepared us to take care of my son once he left the hospital. And we didn't know exactly what the prognosis would be. One of the physicians, and I certainly am not going to share his name, told my wife he might be in a vegetative state, which was pretty devastating to her, obviously. I wasn't there at that point when that happened. But nonetheless, we went home not knowing exactly what we would be dealing with. Turned out my son had severe short-term memory loss, and throughout his recovery period, that didn't improve. It's a long-term condition. We dealt with medications for seizure control because some people who have a brain injury wind up having seizures, and that can be a pretty difficult thing. You can't drive, and so on and so forth. In any event, to make a long story short, I think the most important point I want to make here is that the designation and the recognition that you are a caregiver by the hospital system is very important. We found ourselves in a position where we felt, in some cases, like we were intruding when we wanted to participate. And remember, my son was 21, and of course, there is an ethos that wants to treat those people as, you know, adults and individuals. And I understand that, and I even support it. And yet there was a tendency to want to exclude, or at least, well, wait a minute, we want to hear what he has to say. And he was diminished in his capacity because of his memory. And he would, you know, say things that, you know, at least in our judgment, just weren't the case. It was his perception. But I think the designation's really important. If you've been identified as a lay caregiver and you've got some status in the process, that is very important from our experience. I've talked too long.
I take it you support the bill.
What's that?
I take it you support the bill.
I do. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any questions at this panel?
Executive summary.
Thank you very much, guys. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3378. And I'm going to take a detour for a couple of work sessions. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2605. What do we have here, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2605 had a public hearing on February 27th. This requires insurers to submit rate filings to DC Department of Consumer and Business Services no later than 8 months prior to the beginning of open enrollment period for health insurance for the health insurance exchange. And I think Representative Nose will speak to the Dash 3 amendment.
Representative Nose.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rob Nose. I'm the state representative for House District 42, which is inner southeast and northeast Portland, and I'm here today to ask you to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to the bill and then send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. These amendments are the result of extensive discussion between the insurance division, the Oregon's Health Co-op, Osberg, and several health insurance companies, including Cambia Health. The Dash 3 amendments change the bill and would have the insurance division issue a preliminary decision regarding insurance rates after reviewing a company's rate file. Insurers and then any person who feels adversely affected or aggrieved by the preliminary decision of the insurance division can then meet with that division, discuss their concerns with the preliminary decision, to try to get that worked out and change. The Dash 3 amendments also allow an insurer to accept the rate proposed by the insurance division while pursuing an appeal, so they can participate in the exchange while still retain the right to appeal a decision they disagreed with. It allows for an expedited process in which an insurer could go directly to the director of DCBS regarding their rate proposal. Insurers could also pursue the traditional administrative appeal process if they like, but this expedited process allows the insurers to gain a second look at their modified rate before they have to enter the exchange for the coming year. Lastly, there are a few points of mild contention of which the various stakeholders were not able to come to consensus. These Dash 3 amendments that are before you have the insurance division convening a work group of stakeholders to issue recommendations later this year on how to address their concerns with the rate setting process. So I know that Lori Freeman from LC and some other experts are here if you guys have any detailed questions. Other than that, I'd ask you to adopt the Dash 3.
And mostly there's consensus behind
there is. I'm not aware at this point of anybody that's in opposition. I believe everybody is neutral on the bill based on the Dash 3 amendments.
Okay. Come on, join us.
Yeah. Chair Greenlick. I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated 3/24/15.
There's a Hayden. Moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to 2605 dated 3/24/15. Is there any discussion on the Dash 3 amendments? Is there any objection? So moved.
Chair Greenlick, I move House Bill 2605 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves House Bill 2605 as amended with the Dash 3 amendments to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Kenmer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Dyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Weiner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Noth?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2605 to the floor. Who's going to carry?
I'm carrying.
I'll carry it.
Heavy, it's your
I voted yes, Mr. Chair. Can I carry it?
No.
No.
We'll save one for you.
I'll give a convincing speech.
I'm sure you will.
I just like the last time. Close the work session on House Bill 2605 and open a work session on House Bill 2796. For those of you that don't know what the laughing is about, Representative Weiner demonstrated his ability to carry bills last time. We were very impressed.
It was a good bill. It was unanimous.
You said so. Okay. We have a Dash 3 amendment. What's the bill about?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2796 had a public hearing on February 4th. Since that time, they've been working on amendments. What we have before us now is it doesn't create the music therapy board, but it authorizes the health licensing office to create a program that issues licenses to practice music therapy. The Dash 3 amendment specifies the licensing criteria for applicants. It authorizes the licensing office to adopt rules for licensing, qualification, and standards. Prohibits persons from practicing music therapy or using the title of music therapist without a license. It adds an emergency clause. This bill did come back with a fiscal impact, Mr. Chair, so if the committee does adopt the amendment, it's a recommendation that it be forwarded to Ways and Means.
All right, who's got the motion?
I do.
You ready?
I am ready.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated April 3rd, 2015.
Representative Noss moves we adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated 4/3/13.
50.
I think that's right. 4/3/15. Is there any discussion on the amendments? Is there any objection? So moved.
You like another motion?
If we're in the same year, we might as well.
Yes, we are. Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2796 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Noss moves we move House Bill 2796 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. and that the bill be referred to the committee, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Dyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries, and 2796 is on its way to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 2796 and open two public hearings at the same time to complete the witness list that we didn't finish on Friday. So I'm opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2875 and on House Bill 3178. And I think we have three witnesses. Is that right?
We do. For 2875, there was John Eames, Lisa Trussell, Elise Brown. John Eames also signed up for 3178. So okay. Then we'll have one more after that.
And one more witness after that. Mr. Eames, you can talk about however you want. You can do 3178. That's what we have. The most witnesses on?
No, the least.
The least. All right, why don't you use 3178 first? You're sure. All along on that one.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames, and thank you for the opportunity to come here and talk to you. I'm talking on behalf of CVS Health, which is a pharmacy benefits manager. The two bills are, they're kind of two in the same a little bit because the amendments for one of the bills is kind of similar to the other bill. So I think 2875 was originally as drafted kind of a study or looking at the effectiveness of the bills that were passed in 2013 or the bill that was passed in 2013, but they've adopted or there's amendments on that bill that were kind of encapsulated what was going on in 3178. So, well, I've talked to a number of you about where we are and how we've gotten to this point. We, just to kind of give a little bit of a recap, in 2012 there was a bill brought forward for the February legislative session that was ultimately not passed, and they had at the time said, okay, let's do a work group and study it over the interim and then potentially bring something back for the 2013 legislative session. So I was on that work group as a representative of the PBMs and a representative of my client, CVS. And so we worked through those that interim time period, got to the legislative session, and there were some bills that were proposed, which I'm fully honest and tell you that we were not pleased with, we were not happy with. But over the course of that entire legislative session, we worked with the sponsor of the bills, Representative Jules Bailey, who's no longer here, but he does keep texting me. Last week, for example, he texted me about these bills. We worked very hard with the sponsors of the original legislation in 2013 to a place where we weren't happy with everything that was passed. But we testified, actually I testified in front of this committee in 2013 as neutral on the changes that we made during the 2013 legislative session, and they were substantial. There were a number of them that took significant steps forward on transparency issues, on pricing, on payments to pharmacies. And so those bills, or the elements of those bills, some of them were implemented right away, some of them were delayed, but the last piece of it was actually implemented in January of this year. So we come to the current bill, which is being introduced to you during this legislative session, which if we are to look at the dash one or dash two amendments, I can't remember which ones they are. I think it's the dash one amendments on 2875, do make some fairly significant policy changes in how pharmacy benefit managers reimburse pharmacies for dispensing of drugs. And I know that there were some questions and there were some tough questions from Representative Greenlick to a representative from the PBM community, Ms. Cindy Laubacher, on Friday. And I'm happy to answer those questions now, too, if you have hard questions. But what we wanted to emphasize was the way we got there in 2013 was through a huge amount of discussion and a lot of work group meetings and a lot of back and forth. I mean, just the definition of quote-unquote fraud, which is changed in the bill that or the amendment that's before you on 2875, took weeks of negotiation of back and forth to get to a place where we got to neutral. And so because these are significant policy changes, and they have ramifications down the line. It's not just about PBMs. It's about our clients, which our clients are local governments. They're insurers. They are large employers. They're the state of Oregon. There's cities, counties, municipalities. There's implications for cost and efficacy all the way down the line when we make these significant changes. And so I'd say from someone who's been there since 2012, that's what we do during a legislative session. We obviously make policy changes, but they are big changes. They're not something that should be taken lightly. And we have some concerns. And we have someone here from some CVS who could allay or communicate some of the concerns of the specifics of the bill, if you'd like to hear that. I know you're shaking your head. But I think it's also instructive to know what the role of the PBM is and why oftentimes, you know, I was in with some legislators who expressed concerns specifically about PBMs. You know, their role in the healthcare delivery system is a tough one because it's not a pleasant one. The role is to, for their clients, which we've already talked about, their role is to keep those healthcare costs low. And sometimes that doesn't make folks happy because there's limited choice, obviously, when you're trying to keep an adequate network for your clients. There are some things that go on that not everybody is happy about. But we do is take a look at what the drugs that are being dispensed and encourage pharmacies to dispense the lowest cost drug available. And that is not always easy, but pharmacies do have an opportunity when they do dispense those drugs, and it is for loss. And, you know, I want you to know that I actually talked to Ann Murray, who testified before you on Friday, as well as Jerry, I can't remember his last name, from Baker City. I talked to him the day before about what their concerns were. And some of the concerns, you know, are obviously legitimate concerns. You know, they want to be able to talk to someone at the PBM that knows what they're talking about. They want to have access to be able to appeal in a quickly and timely manner. And some of the things that we implemented in 2013, as far as the changes that we made, were to increase transparency. They were to look at how we reimburse retroactively so that when someone files an appeal, they get reimbursed back to that appeal time. So these are changes that were made, and we need to see how they are going to work. You know, the number of complaints, and I think you had someone from DCBS or some folks had personal meetings where they testified, and I'll let them speak for themselves, but my understanding is that the number of complaints are fairly low. And if there's big overarching concerns here about whether or not these laws are effective or whether PBMs are actually following the law, which is a legitimate question to ask, then we need to address that through the process that we set up in 2013, which is the complaint process, where the Department of Insurance has the ability to, you know, make those changes. If it's not effective, then yes, let's have that question. Let's have that conversation. If they don't have the enforcement mechanisms they need to do to hold us responsible and accountable to the statute and to the law, absolutely, we need to adjust and change to be able to allow them to do that. But I'm getting the speed up. I just want to say in closing that these are very complicated decisions. The drug delivery system from the pharmaceutical manufacturer to the end user client goes through a number of steps. And, you know, the way we are in the world right now, everyone's getting squeezed. And that causes problems, and it causes issues for people who are trying to make it there. So I know that this is not easy, and it's not a great role for the PBM as the kind of the intermediary between the client, the payer, and the actual pharmacy and the end user. But that's what our role is to try to save that money for the healthcare system and for those ultimately for the client anyway. So I'll stop there, and I can answer any questions if you'd like.
Are there any questions? Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
So, John, I think the thing that a lot of us are wondering is,
sure,
how is it that a pharmacist can lose $200? That's the thing I think most of us don't understand.
You bet. Okay, so Representative Nose, members of the committee, it's an excellent question because this is where it gets complicated. So one of the questions that Representative Greenlick asked on Friday was, you know, how can you force someone to dispense a drug for a loss? I mean, that doesn't seem right.
Big loss.
A big loss. Now, what you have to understand is that the MAC, or the maximum allowable cost list, which is the list that PBMs develop for pharmacies to give them an understanding of how drugs will be priced and how they actually end up will be reimbursed for the drugs that they're buying, because the pharmacies buy the drug and then reimburse them, PBMs reimburse them for the cost of that drug, is that it, you have to look over the book of business. The MAC setup where the vast majority of your drugs, you want them to be making money on, because they have, we set the MAC in most cases for above what the lowest cost drug is. So if there's six drugs in a class, you know, six generic drugs, we don't want the pharmacy to buy at the highest cost. You want them to buy at the lowest cost, or as the lowest available cost. And then we reimburse them above that lowest cost, so they make a profit on that if they're buying and they're doing smart buying. So on the case of the $200 or the $400, and I talked to Jerry as well the day before, kind of describing that, there's a lot of factors that go into why that would happen, but we'd have to look over, first of all, the entire book to see exactly what they're doing on the rest of the drugs that they're buying. And in that case, they have the right to appeal that price. If if there was a mistake in the way that they should have been reimbursed, or if there wasn't another readily available lowest cost drug, then they have the right to appeal and to be reimbursed for that. Now, that is that option, but they also don't appeal the ones where they make a lot of money on, or where they make more money. I mean, we were talking about today where some drugs that were dispensed, there could be a spread when that max changes to and where they get a whole bunch of money on top of that. So there can be a variety of discrepancies between what we actually reimburse depending on when that max is updated, and there's pros and cons. Yes.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Chair. So if I recall the conversation correctly, part of the argument was how long it takes to hear from appeal, and in some cases they never heard back. So is there some standards about if they file an appeal, how long it takes, or whether they're supposed to hear or not?
Representative Limey, member of the committee, that is a very legitimate concern. I don't know what each PBM's specific appeal timeline or when do they get out. I can get that information for you. I don't think it's ever the PBM's intent to string someone out. Our responsibility, we have to have, especially in rural areas, we have to have pharmacies. If we don't have that pharmacy, we're not meeting the needs of our clients or their network adequacy. They're subject to statute, and we're subject to our client to make sure. So that's why we pay rural pharmacies more than we do urban pharmacies. We pay them a higher rate. And it's not in our best interest to have pharmacies go out of business. That is just, we can't have that happen. So I don't think it, I mean, there may be some cases. And as I told Ms. Murray and Jerry, his last name, there could be some very legitimate concerns. And if there's some issues that they're having with individual PBMs, we'd like to try to address that. But, and I don't want to, I mean, I'm sure that their concerns are valid. But that's not right if they never get back to them. Absolutely.
Thank you, Chair Greenlink. Two questions. Jonathan, is the MAC pricing the same for all pharmacies, or is it vary depending on negotiations?
Representative Bueller, members of the committee, that's a good question. I'm sure that someone, I think the MAC may differ based upon the clientele. So, for example, if your client is the state of Oregon, or if you have a different client, but I'm not sure about that, but I can find out.
Okay. The second question.
You said rural pharmacies are paid more.
Yes, they are. Yes, because.
Well, that's one example. Yeah.
Oh, well, yes, that may be for their dispensing fee. It may be so they so
may not be for the MAC on the drug itself.
Right, but I don't know for sure. So, again, I have an expert here if you need
that answer for me.
No, you bet.
And then I'm curious about the complaint process. Why do you think so few, if this is such a big problem, why are so few complaints being filed?
Representative Bueller, members of the committee, it's a legitimate question. I think we need to dig into that a little bit more. I mean, it'd be easy for me to say, yeah, exactly right. But I think it's more fair to say, well, let's have that conversation about that. The process that we set up in the interim to be able to have those complaints be filed with the Department of Insurance, maybe there's a barrier. I don't know. Or maybe there's not, and it's not as overarching of a concern. But I think it's a legitimate conversation to have, and I think it's reasonable to say, why have there been only six? And most of those complaints were mostly technical. So that's a concern.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know how the pharmacies are learning about the complaint process? And then is there a log? Is there some data on exactly what the complaints are so far?
I think there's also Representative Bueller. I think there's a representative from DCBS or Department of Insurance here as well.
I need to see if you can get us that information.
Absolutely, we'll do.
And I'll get it from DCBS.
We'll get it from DCBS. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3178. We're in a public hearing now for House Bill 2875.
Do you want to speak to that one?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just quickly, on the underlying bill where we're looking at potentially doing a look back, I think that's a very legit or kind of a study on whether the bill is effective and whether the efficacy of the laws and whether the efficacy of the department is, to your question, Representative Bueller. The only thing I would say about that is to make sure that the process has enough time and data to be able to compile all the data that's necessary to see whether it's effective or not. That's the first question and the first thing. And then also, it doesn't say anything here in the bill or in the underlying bill about involving a number of stakeholders and a variety of stakeholders. I think whenever you want to look at an individual bill where you're doing a study and whether it's effective, it takes a fairly negative connotation in that bill as if there is fault, as opposed to, well, let's take a look and see if it's working. So, you know, you can draft it how you want, but instead of trying to plant the seed, let's try to look at this with open eyes and trying to be fair to everybody who's involved and not having a negative connotation going forward. And the best way to do that is to involve this number of stakeholders. That's all I'd like to say. Thank you.
Go for it.
All right, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Elise Brown for AHIP.
Jonathan, can we get Bill Cross up to take in your chair?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Which Sorry, is the National Trade Association, America's Health Insurance Plans. And just a couple points, Mr. Chair. And here today in opposition to House Bill 2875. So 2 points. Number one, this committee knows best that the increasing cost of prescription drugs is a key component of the rising cost of health care. One of the tools that carriers have in their pocket is our ability to contract with PBMs to help manage prescription drug benefits. The PBMs are negotiating drug prices with pharmacies and manufacturers on behalf of the health plans. And in addition to other administrative, clinical, and cost containment services, they also help process drug claims. So this equates to savings that is ultimately passed on to consumers, therefore our members. This bill will change that. Second point, AHIP and members also participated in the 2012 discussions around House Bill 2123. As John told you, the process started in 2012 and it led to a consensus bill at the end in House Bill 2123. And just recently, OID has implemented the regulations that were effective in July 21, 2014. So that bill has just become effective. And it is our hope, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that we let that legislation take a little longer to settle in before we make massive changes. I'm going to let my other AHIP member, Lisa Trussell, talk a little further, and then we'll be happy to answer questions.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Lisa Trussell with Health Plan of Oregon, and here in opposition to 2875, the -1 amendment. And for reasons that I won't cover the points that Jonathan and Elise have already hit, but I would like to reiterate that we do need pharmacies in our network, and we do need community pharmacies, particularly for our rural areas. So having a pharmacy it goes beyond just network adequacy. It goes to servicing our customers. The other thing is that if the PBMs aren't following the law, then let DCBS, that's overseeing that, take a look at what is being missed. But it was a understanding that there were about a half a dozen complaints is what I've heard from on this issue. The other thing I'd like to remind people is that the bulk of purchasers at pharmacies today are not in the commercial market. PEB, OEB, Medicaid, Medicare is huge. Oregon's heavy on Medicare Advantage. And so I don't know if the problems that the pharmacies are identifying are limited to the commercial market, but I would suggest that the practices, we contract with PPMs because they can get better rates. We're in four states. We're a regional carrier, and we have a large TRICARE population on the East Coast. And even with the size of the overall membership, we can get better deals by going through a PBM on pricing that gets back to our members. And I would also suggest that there are probably, as there are different PBMs, we change them periodically, there are probably different pharmacy service administrative organizations or purchasers for the different pharmacies on their drugs. So what I would like to ask is that we wait and see what the complaints are and how they're resolved at DCBS, and let 2123, which I think there were the last elements were just implemented, I believe, in January 1st. Let that try to work first before we go about making significant changes. And the one thing that I'm waiting to hear back on, and I was unable to get it in time for Friday, was what the impact of changing maximum allowable costs to maximum reimbursement amount means. And in my mind, they sound the same, but I know there's a reason that somebody suggested that change, so I'm trying to find that out, but I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Bill Cross?
Yes, members of the committee, Nikki Terzia.
You're not Bill Cross,
I'm not
are
Bill.
You?
Bill Cross has suggested I sit in. He's sorry he can't be here. He's also recommended, we do have a pharmacist from Grants Pass who's come in today and is able to answer some questions if the committee is willing to allow. And seeing shaking heads, I'm Nikki Terzieff on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Coalition. We are here in support of the Dash 1 amendments for 2875, and you heard last week from the pharmacists who are affected directly by 2123 and some of the lack of teeth, if you will, within that bill. So I'll just quickly respond to some of the comments I've heard here today. One was a question about enforcement at DCBS. It's absolutely the overseeing agency. Unfortunately, in 2123, we didn't give them the necessary tools in that vehicle to be able to really truly enforce some of the pieces that were phased in. And that's to a second point, the phase in of the pieces of 2123. It is true that while the last portion on pricing has just been in effect for those 3 months, in those 3 months, the very pharmacist who is here with me has already seen a loss of about $15,000 within her quarter one statement. And that piece, having been in effect for so little time, means they did have a full year to be able to prepare for it. The other piece is complaints logged. We do see that there were only 6 complaints logged. Those are formally logged complaints from somebody who's very energetic about this. Many pharmacists don't have the time or the capability to log all of those complaints, and in the past, having not seen a lot of recourse or having no recourse, have often, I'll say, fallen out of habit of logging some of those complaints. Collaboration with the plans is fantastic, and collaboration for patients' care is wonderful, but this squeeze makes rates fall for pharmacists, which means consumer access and patient access for pharmacies also can be squeezed, especially, again, as noted in the rural areas. And finally, I think I might be able to touch on the impact of changing the term MAC within this amendment. What we are concerned with is that it would be very easy to find a new list, label it something different, and fall out of compliance.
All right. Are there any questions, panel?
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going through this and looking at it, do you know if the PBMs pay rebates to your clients?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know what's in our contracts, but I appreciate that question because there were elements of this bill that required PBMs on the amendments to tell us things, and we negotiate a contract with them that tells them what reporting we want back. And I believe rebates are part of the negotiations, but I can't tell you exactly how it applies. But I know I've heard the pharmacist in-house, our director, talk about that. So I believe that we contract with them in some way on those rebates.
Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2875 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3200 for the purpose of clearing the list we had last time. Sandy, what's this bill?
House Bill 3200 was the bill that prohibited health care providers and health insurers from denying a patient 65 years of age or older health care or reimbursement of costs necessary to prevent death based on an advanced age. And the folks that we didn't get to on Friday were Jessica Adamson, Lisa Trussell, and Courtney Dresser.
Will you join us, please?
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. First of all, the Oregon bill supports quality health care for all Oregonians, regardless of age. And as Mr. Gardner stated on Friday, we do have concerns with this particular bill and the legislation. Particularly, we would believe that health care providers could be removed from the bill, and we don't necessarily support the remedy of criminalizing the practice of medicine. So at this point, we're opposed to House Bill 3200.
Do you think if we include providers that dropping people off a panel when they reach Medicare age would be a violation of this?
Chair, I anticipated that question.
I know, I asked last week.
And you and I have been working on that issue for some time. And
how are we doing?
Well, I think it's not as a large-scale issue. And know that, as you remember, the OMA did pass some Board of Trustees policy at our board level that said that we do not support providers dropping a patient just because they age into the Medicare system. With that said, though, we do know that there are some providers who opt out of the system altogether, and we know that there's some who close their doors to new patients.
Yeah, I don't think that's ever been an issue.
So, but we haven't seen a lot of issues with folks dropping
patients. I haven't
heard
something lately, which I was hearing a lot.
Yeah. And, you know, at the federal level, we continue to advocate for better rates of reimbursement at the Medicare level, so we can hope to continue to bring more people into that system, more providers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. We'd like to echo the comments of our colleagues from OMA. We are opposed to this bill in its current form. We absolutely value every single one of our patients, regardless of age, sex, sexual orientation, gender, the whole list of non-discrimination language that is not only kind of a big part of Oregon law, but also as we have gone and looked at the ACA and tried to find the provisions referenced by Mr. Gardner last week, what we have managed to find is kind of broad non-discrimination language. It hasn't been very well defined exactly what that means yet. That's something that, as we understand, the administration is working on. But it applies broadly, not just to the expansion population, but the broader commercial population that is non-discrimination, again, on a wide range of issues. Included in that is age. We absolutely believe that it's important that as we work and we serve patients, that we not only look to their advanced directives, but the wishes of their family, and that ongoing dialogue between doctor and patient around not only what's in the best interest of that patient, but also best evidence based medicine. And so it's the interplay of those two. It's making sure that we balance good outcomes with patient wishes. We believe that it's critical to plan, particularly towards end of life, for what are those patient wishes in not just a form of a checklist, but in a broader way, in a values-based way, so that patients and providers can be clear about what kind of medicine a patient wants as they get older. Because there are those decisions. So that's why we think working on advanced directives, working on POLST is really important. But all of that to say, we do not believe that discrimination in any way is okay, but criminalization of practice of medicine, creating an opportunity for where there could be dispute about intent is a real concern to us. Anything that gets in the way of practice of good evidence-based medicine in consultation with the patient and the patient's wishes, as outlined in an advance directive or a POLST, also concerns us. So we thank the committee, and we have concerns about the bill the way it's written.
But Jessica, I've read your code of ethics very carefully. It's a very strong code of ethics.
Absolutely.
And this bill, it's, as I understand the purpose of this bill, is simply to prevent restricting the application of a therapy simply because of age, not because the patient's wishes, not because of evidence that it won't work, but simply because of age. I mean, as I understand it, no, you're over 75, you don't get access to this expensive medication that you would have gotten access to when you were younger than, say, 75. Certainly, that model is not something that Providence would object to.
Mr. Chair, the underlying...
Maybe issues of the bill and things like that, but certainly the concept can't be.
Mr. Chair, Providence does not at all argue with the concept or the underlying intention of this bill. We do have real concerns with the language and the way it's written and whether current law already provides, especially given the ACA, the kinds of protections that the underlying bill is seeking to have. So we, again, absolutely, we and our code of ethics and our ethical standards of practice and the values and mission of Providence, we absolutely believe that non-discrimination is core and central to that, and that no one should be discriminating on the sole basis of age. But the way the bill is written is where we have significant pause.
Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Trussell with HealthNet Health Plan of Oregon. And I kind of checked on the line rather than saying opposed or support. It is concerns because after listening to the testimony on Friday, it seems that most of the focus, if not all, was on Medicare plans. And in Oregon, as you know, Medicare Advantage is the most widely used Medicare plan in addition. And there isn't a lot of wiggle room. Number one, I don't believe the feds or any, even the state of Oregon, allows any kind of discrimination based on arbitrary terms like age. But I think that if we're talking about Medicare recipients, then it needs to be focused on the Medicare plans, which are outside of the Oregon Insurance Code. And the second thing is that I wanted, and it does raise concerns about who made a decision with the language in the bill, and I want to share an example. Last year in late April, my dad was hospitalized with an torn bowel, and the ER doc came in, and the hospital admit doctor came in and said, he needs to get into surgery right away. And dad had just turned 90, not in good shape. And he had told us all before, I'm not having any more surgery. So I told the doctor, not knowing how severe it was, I said, well, dad doesn't want any more surgeries. And he says, well, if he doesn't, our only option is hospice. So I go in, and dad was, you know, still able to hear. And I said, Dad, they want to operate. And they may be able to fix it while they're in there. Or you may have to, they may go in and see what's wrong and then schedule you for some different procedure. And he just looked up and he said, no more surgeries. But my point is, depriving him of that surgery that they were actually really hoping he would take, down the road, somebody could have said, well, why in the heck didn't they do that surgery on him? It's because he was 90 years old.
Not if it was his choice.
Well, but who's going to be determine whose choice it was? That is what gets into the horrible realm of the litigation mode.
But it seems to me what this bill would say is, if they said to him, well, if you were 10 years younger, we'd do the surgery, and he said, but I want the surgery anyway, and you said, no, you're too old for it, and we'd have done it if you were 75, but we're not going to do it if you're 90, that would be what this bill is about.
And I understand that, except for after an event has happened, particularly after someone has passed away, then you're going to have people second-guessing that everything wasn't done. And I think that it will get into a he said, she said in a litigation mode is all I'm saying.
Okay. Are there any questions, this panel?
Representative Widener.
Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's kind of more of a comment, and I don't know if one of you wants to address it, because I mean, you hit on a very key point there, is the litigation piece afterwards. So, because I'm actually a supporter of this bill, depending upon the situation, because we had the same thing with my grandmother at 95, 98, 90, with some of the issues. And I'm just wondering if there's a way legislatively we could actually correct that with what we're doing.
You know, and I don't know of where there's been example where there's been an age discrimination issue in a commercial plan, and I think that this bill is changing the insurance code for commercial plan. So to me, I don't believe that the insurance commissioner would approve a plan that determined benefits by age. I know when they were adopting the applied behavioral analysis, best practices were for a certain age group, and the insurance commissioner pointed out that that violates anything with an age violates federal law.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
We close a public hearing on House Bill 3200 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3174. Hold on a minute. Stand at ease just for a moment, please. I think this bill is we're back in session. Sandy, I've opened up a public hearing on 3174. What do we have?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3174 requires the Oregon Board of Pharmacy to notify the person subject to an investigation for violation of proposed disciplinary action to advise the person to retain an attorney, to impose any penalties that are commensurate with the offense, and to consider the person's professional record in imposing a penalty. We have Bill Cross, Nikki, I'm sorry, and Marcus Watt, if you want to come together separately.
You better be careful who you hang out with.
I always do.
Chair Greenlick, members of the House Healthcare Committee, Nikki Terzieff again here on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Coalition. We are, just to recap, both Main Street pharmacists as well as health system-based pharmacists, so we really get to serve patients at all access points within the healthcare delivery system. 3174, I think, is probably fairly well-intentioned, but the coalition has taken a position of concern with this bill that it may disrupt the Board of Pharmacy's operations. And we haven't seen a lot of significant complaints or concern arising from what this bill is trying to address, and so we're hoping that we can allow the Board of Pharmacy to do what it does still. Thank you.
You're opposed.
We are opposed, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlee and committee members, my name is Marcus Watt.
I'm in favor.
Pardon me?
You're in favor of the bill, right?
No. we're officially neutral.
Oh, okay.
I'm here representing the Board of Pharmacy, and I'd like to share some of the concerns that we have about House Bill 3174. The mission of the Board of Pharmacy is to protect the citizens of Oregon by regulating the profession of pharmacy as well as the commerce of all drugs within the state. House Bill 3174, as written, would place significant barriers in our ability to conduct a fair and extensive investigation. House Bill 3174 would require that upon receipt of a complaint, the board staff notify the licensee, who is the focus of the complaint, the existence of the complaint, the outcome of the investigation, and then the outcome of the board action, if there were to be any, prior to even implementing the investigation itself. So, in effect, it is asking for the outcome of the entire process before we would even begin the process. So it'd be very, it'd be impossible to completely comply with this. At best, we would be able to offer our best estimate, but it would be most likely incorrect. Many investigations require the gathering of information prior to contact with or interviewing a licensee. Implementation of this bill would have a chilling effect on the complaint process. Fewer people would be willing to file complaints if they knew that their employer, their coworker, or their supervisor were to be aware of a complaint within a day or two of the complaint being filed. It would allow a licensee to destroy or alter documents critical to an investigation. It would allow a licensee to pressure or coerce testimony from others. It would allow a licensee to destroy or alter time-sensitive information that is critical to a controlled substance use or diversion investigation. We believe it would significantly drive up our DOJ expenses. And we would most likely miss two legislative mandated KPMs by having to implement this. Additionally, the Board of Pharmacy's Attorney General advises us that there are some legal issues with several aspects of the bill. Section 13B requires that the Board of Pharmacy advise the person to retain an attorney when we really have no statutory authority to require them to have an attorney. Additionally, he tells us that in Section 13A, some of the terms that are used there are what is considered to be terms of art in administrative law, and their usage in the section is both confusing and contrary to current applications in law. Lastly, I would just like to say that the Board of Pharmacy has had a long history of attempting to gain compliance through education. We would much rather spend our time educating our licensees on the correct way to do things than we would conducting investigations. I can give you numerous examples of how we do this, but the end result is that we would much rather spend that time, educate them, and not end up disciplining them. This approach through the years has resulted in a fairly high compliance rate with a reduced disciplinary processes. And I guess lastly, I would just like to say that now, I don't know what the genesis of this bill was, but I would say it's probably safe to say there are a few unhappy licensees out there somewhere in the state. And I'd like to commit to you as a committee and the bill sponsors that I will commit whatever time is necessary to address whatever concerns brought about this bill so that we can possibly avoid statutory response to something that I personally don't believe is a very big issue.
I think the bill came from Representative Benz, is that right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. It would be good if you contact him.
I'd be more than happy to. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions of either witness? Representative Kenemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, you know, as I read the language, it says advise the person to retain counsel. That automatically makes it a legal issue and makes it very difficult for you to talk to the individual because you have to talk to their attorney.
Absolutely.
And that just about predisposes it to being a battle rather than a professional discussion. And I say this having served on the Board of Psychologist Examiners. Once a person retained a lawyer, we had to be very careful that we spoke through our lawyer and that a very expensive process was what ensued. And I share that concern, and I think it's a serious one because as I understand it, our boards are predicated on the notion of resolving these in a professional manner, which is an ethical, honest, best interest of the public.
Absolutely. And in 2014, approximately 20% of our cases were resolved as no violation or no jurisdiction. And those were resolved simply by doing a short investigation, a discussion with a licensee, and then that was the end of the complaint.
Mr. Hayden?
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. First of all, I want to make sure you're not going to add another board to my list of boards to try and get together with.
They've been behaving well. They can. Okay. And besides, if you ask him to meet with you, he'd meet with you.
Okay. So on a more serious note, as I read this bill, it looks to me that it must be case-based. I mean, there must be a case out there or an individual out there that's driving this. Are we aware of what that case is?
I am not.
And secondarily, most of the boards, I'm not going to say all, but when they interact with the practitioner, I guess in this case a pharmacist, and ask for records, obviously that license holder is informed. Does the pharmacy have a way around that this is like, can you get the records without the pharmacist knowing?
It's good for business.
It depends. Many times we can. In the example of a chain pharmacy, if we needed the records without notifying the licensee, we could get them. In other cases, though, where they control those records, it would be possible for them to be aware of it prior to our being able to take action. Does that answer your question?
Well, I guess my question is, it seems like my guess is there, if the Board of Pharmacy starts looking at an individual person's records, let's say they start the investigation, start gathering information, and then when they drill down to the point of actually pulling that individual practitioner's record, I think a lot of the boards do notify, say, okay, we want your chart, right?
Yeah.
So they have to notify. I'm just trying to get a feel for how this is different from that.
We license not only the pharmacists but the outlets. Many of the records are owned by or accessible by the outlet. So we have a requirement of documentation of counseling, for example, and those are owned by the outlet. If we needed that information and we were to notify a licensee that they had not done something, it would be very easy for them to go and have the record get lost, have the record be altered in some way before we could get to it, unless we did it prior to contacting them.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Roughly what proportion of cases do you notify somebody before you start the investigation?
Well, I would have to guess. I don't know the answer to that.
Is it pretty unusual that you notify them and say, we're coming to investigate you?
I'd have to break it down two ways. 60% of our complaints are actually generated by our inspectors when they're doing inspections. And those, yes, the licensee is absolutely aware of it at the time that it happens. We start looking for corroborating information at the time that we're there, unless they're physically not in the pharmacy at the time that it happens. But we also have to leave records, and we discuss it with the people that are there. So in the case where one of our inspectors initiated a complaint based on inspection, they would be very much aware of it. If it were someone calling from the outside with a complaint of some sort, depending on the complaint, we would in some cases, and in other cases we would not contact them until we had the other information to corroborate.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you both for testifying.
Thank you for your time.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3174 and reopen the public hearing on 2875. We have three witnesses that we'll invite up.
Michelle Belcher, Moral Farzi, and Tom Holt.
In the order, just identify yourself.
So, Representative Greenlick and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. My name is Michelle Belcher. I'm a second-generation pharmacist and small business pharmacy owner from Grants Pass. Grants Pass Pharmacy has been serving our community and extended county for since 1933. My family has owned it since 1973. I am also on the board of directors for the National Community Pharmacists Association. I am here in strong support of the amendments being proposed for House Bill 2875. As a pharmacist who was directly involved with the passage of 2123, now Chapter 570, I can assure you that these proposed amendments to this important law are needed. The measures being proposed within the amendments to House Bill 2875 simply ensures that the law currently in place will be properly complied with by adding and amending language that reinforces the original intent of the law. And I would like to really stress that because we're talking about original intent. As a pharmacy owner, I continue to deal with delayed price updates on a daily basis. I continue to not receive appeals in the required time frame. In fact, most of the time, the PBMs fail to directly update me on MAC prices at all, leaving me oftentimes to dispense at a notable loss. Last week, I completed a summary of first quarter 2015 generic drug transactions and found that over $15,000 in prescriptions were dispensed below cost. And that's below the invoice that I paid to my wholesaler. It is apparent that the PBMs in Oregon have simply failed to comply with the intent, again, of the previously enacted law.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, please.
That $15,000, is that how much the loss was or how much the total volume of those prescriptions were?
That is just the loss, and I've brought that report here. And there is not one glaring PBM. It is throughout. Each bold face is a different PBM. So I can say that there is not one glaring PBM, but it's throughout the entire.
Can I ask a question, too?
And
did you say that's for the last quarter? Does it include the 3 months since the old law went into effect?
This is January through March 2015. Okay.
Since the law went into effect,
that had a year to prepare for.
Okay,
And I think that was very important to me to try to look at those numbers. And I can say was honestly looking them on a day-to-day basis, but not adding them up until then. It is apparent that the PBMs have failed to comply with the original intent of the previously enacted law, which is why it is so necessary for the legislature to revisit the legislative language. House Bill 2875 takes many necessary steps to ensure the intent of Oregon's law is not undermined. Other states, it's been brought up that this is a law that just went into effect, and other states, such as Arkansas, also enacted a law, passed a law in 2013. And just last week, they also had to look at the language that was used in that original law, and they strengthened their law to allow pharmacists to be able to refuse to fill on the basis of being paid below cost and show their invoices proof. So we are not the only state that is looking at this as a challenge, and I think that as a small business owner, I'm purely trying to be able to stay in business, to continue to help the patients that I've served, that I have relationships with, that I want to be in the community to help. And absolutely, we have a problem with the fact that there have been not more complaints filled with DCBS, and we are looking at that as a pharmacy coalition within the state to make sure that our members are educated as to that process and how we need to each do our part. The day-to-day in terms of working and helping our patients, that's what sometimes gets maybe that we're taxed by the end of the day of what we're our profession is all about. And so doing something and filing appeals, we need to express to my colleagues that we need to, if we want change, we need to make that happen by also complying with the law and filing those complaints. So that is something that I recognize that we do have to do our part. So in conclusion, as a small business owner, I am urging you to support the amendments being proposed in House Bill 2875 that would strengthen Oregon's already existing legislation to ensure for a fair and transparent pharmaceutical marketplace. This much-needed legislation takes necessary steps to ensure that the true intent of Chapter 570 is properly implemented and enforced. We, as Oregon pharmacists, are not asking anything more of the legislature than to support the intent of the original law and ensure that the law is complied with properly through the addition of the amendments in 2875. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Maral Farsi, and I am with CVS Health. You guys heard from John Eames earlier, who described the history of what we did working with the state and Representative Jules Bailey several years ago. And that was a pretty, I think, a really good process, bringing all the stakeholders to the table to figure out what the best solution is to meet the needs of the pharmacies in Oregon. The amendments in this bill, specifically the Dash 1 amendments, we fear are going to have significant cost impact to patients, payers, and the state. Let me talk specifically about the two amendments that stood out most to me. One was that one that we negotiated several years ago, and that's how many drugs are on the how many generic drugs have to be out in the market before we can actually place them on a MAC list. As you guys can imagine, when generic drugs come out, it drives the cost down. So we want to place them on a MAC list, and that ends up in cost savings. If there's one generic out in the market, you would think that the costs come down overall. Currently in the amendment, there's three generic drugs that have to be available for it to be mapped. It doesn't make sense to have that that number of drugs when we could be seeing cost savings when there's just even one generic drug. However, that was negotiated several years ago, so that's an unnecessary amendment in my opinion. Another point is the language that would guarantee pharmacies profits on every drug that's dispensed. Again, you guys have heard it mentioned multiple times, there's drugs that pharmacies lose on, and there's drugs that they gain on, and the overall should be a gain. The drug supply chain is very complicated. There's wholesalers. Let me back up. There's manufacturers that set prices on the drugs. There's wholesalers that then make arrangements to sell those drugs. Then pharmacies often contract with these pharmacy service administrative organizations that also make purchasing deals on behalf of the pharmacies they work with. And every step of the way, yes, there's somebody making money, but the prices are, the rules are becoming more and more restricted. So frequently what we hear from a lot of pharmacies is that maybe the drug that they were trying to purchase, they couldn't get from the wholesaler that they're tied to through their pharmacy service administrative organization. That they could potentially find it through a competing wholesaler, but that's not one that may be available to them through their PSAO. So again, this is very complex, and we're of course open to hearing how the law can be changed or improved so that folks feel that, you know, the law's intent is being met. But we certainly think that we've had these conversations and that the law as it is strong. Also, just a couple of other points that were mentioned earlier I'd like to address. Somebody asked about the time frame for appeals. In 21-23, several years ago, that was placed at 30 days. So PBMs do have 30 days only to respond to an appeal. If that's not happening, that would be something I would think should be reported to the Department of Insurance. That's not what I believe CVS Health is doing. Let me just clarify that. And then language such as the amendment that would guarantee profits was introduced in another state, and the state came out with a fiscal note saying that for every 1% increase in drug prices, it's going to cost the state $4.4 million. So that's what we're really talking about, is, you know, our the overall cost is what we're trying to manage as PBMs. And finally, just to clarify, MAC prices are currently available to all pharmacies. We personally have a provider portal that pharmacies can log into, see what their MAC prices are, and pharmacies typically can run a dummy claim to see what they would be getting reimbursed. With that, I will conclude and answer any questions I can.
Thank you. Let's have Mr. Holt, and then we'll open up for questions.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. We operate our own drug program, but I also bring to this some background having, in a prior life, I served on the executive committee of one of the country's largest generic drug purchasing groups. So I know enough about this MAC process to be dangerous. And I'll try not to get too far out over my skis, but in general terms, without repeating what others have said. You know, the MAC system was really a creation recognizing that pricing on generics can change very rapidly, often just day to day. So on any given day, a drug may be available to purchase at price X, and the next day it's available at purchase at price Y to the pharmacy. And that can happen for lots of reasons. Suppliers jump in and out of the market. If some jump out, then prices go out. If some jump in, they go down. And so the idea of the MAC system is to overall allow the pharmacies to provide a service and to make a fair return. It's not a guarantee of making a profit on every single drug, and it never has been. The bill that we had in 2013, which I participated in the work group on, was a many months process. And what it would do, as others have noted, is really make it a cost plus for all products rather than a negotiated overall pricing. It's important to keep in perspective that for all health benefits, that's the case, that it's an overall pricing. To take the simplest, the most rudimentary example, a primary care visit gets paid at, whatever the rate is. Some patients that a doctor sees in the course of a day are going to take a whole lot of time, and some are going to be really easy and not take up much time at all. And that's kind of a gain loss within that kind of fee system. That's to some degree an oversimplification, but it's very much in line with the way the MAC system is designed to work.
Tom,
now the pharmacies.
Let me interrupt you.
Yeah.
You know, I once in a former life was a pharmacist, and I taught pharmacy administration for several years. And I may not know how pharmacies work, but I was told. The reason a MAC can go today from $600 to $200 today is because I could have bought that drug for $200 somewhere, but I didn't. I bought it for $600, and I can't send that one back and get a $200 drug I have in my inventory so I can fill a prescription, a $600 drug. Now, it seems to me the basic notion that drop was to force me to become a better purchaser is okay if I had 30 days, say, to become a better purchaser. I can understand that sense. If the MAC changed and there was a 30-day delay, then I would say, okay, 30 days now, I better get my house in order and get my inventory into the price. This sort of instantaneous, I'll change my MAC list every day in order to get pharmacists to respond to the MAC list to purchase the drugs that are on the market. Just in a practical, real-world sense doesn't make any sense to me.
Chair Greenlick, let me clarify what I meant by the pricing changing on a day-to-day basis. It's more the acquisition price that changes very frequently. We don't update our MAC lists that often.
Well, and I hear it's updated very often.
They are updated frequently. And we have an appeals process, have had an appeals process in place long before we did the bill. That a pharmacy could contact us and show us that, hey, I paid $125 for this drug that I can only get reimbursement of $100, and then we try to make that right if the pharmacy reasonably could not have obtained the product at the lower price. But that's the nature of how the MAC pricing works, and there's other players involved. The drug wholesaler, the pharmacies have the ability to join very large purchasing groups, where an independent pharmacy like Grants Pass Pharmacy can, you know, purchase with thousands of other pharmacies and get a better deal. So it's, you know, the bill as amended, I think, would have some consequences that are not necessarily intended. It also does some things that I think would be inefficient. You know, what we set up in the bill that passed in 2013 was that PBMs would have an obligation to make available, easily accessible to the pharmacy, a price check, where I believe the amendments have us pushing that out constantly. And you know, while that might sound good in theory, in terms of actual workflow of people being able to get that information in a useful form, we don't think that would work very well and would add a lot of cost. So this is an area fraught with complexity, and you know, I, like others, would urge that we take a careful look at what's actually been implemented and how it's working before we make very, very significant policy changes that would be represented in the amendments. Now, there is another, I think, the underlying bill in terms of having a report back, I think is a good idea, and would recommend that we pursue that, but with a report back sometime next year so that we actually have real data on which to base further policy tweaks.
Is there any questions?
Oh, yeah.
Why not?
So I don't pretend to understand the MAC just yet, but I'm getting there. The part that I do understand is that people are concerned that the enforcement mechanism that we've put into the current law isn't very strong, right? It's not that, like, at the end of the day, we can make a complaint, but the DCBS isn't really empowered to do much about that complaint. And then a small pharmacist, a small business owner, would have to actually go to court and hire a lawyer to try to seek justice. And so how do we address that part? Because I think, you know, if the complaint process doesn't have a meaningful vehicle other than going to court, and you have to go up against a big PBM, it seems like it's really not a very viable option.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Nose, two things there. One of the things we did in 2013 was the PBMs have to be licensed in the state, so DCBS does have some leverage over the PBM. And generally speaking, in its statutes, the DCBS has a range of sanctions available to them. We also need to remember that the PBM is contracted ultimately by a health plan, and the health plan becomes a vehicle for DCBS to enforce. And again, they have a wide range of sanctions available and have a history of using them when necessary. So I think we're, you know, if that's something that needs some tweaking, I think we'd certainly be interested in taking a longer look at that. But we believe the mechanisms already exist through the existing licensing and sanctions under that for both health plans and PBMs.
Quick comment. I think what we're hearing from the pharmacists is that they're worried that maybe that's not true from their perspective. I think that's what they're concerned about. One thing. That, Mac.
Commissioner Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this can either be to CVS or Tom if you want to try it or whatever, but I'm sitting here, I'm looking at this. I can go to Walmart and get prescriptions for $4. Maybe we should use Walmart for our PBM because they're not playing games with the pricing, because I'm looking at some of the stuff like CVS, you have your own pharmacies, so now I'm telling this pharmacist that you have to go buy from your competitor, and they're going to make markup or margin off of theirs, so you got like three hands in the pie, where Walmart goes out and negotiates directly. And I'm wondering why we're stopping pharmacists from being able to go direct and work together as part of a cooperative or buying group. Because right now there's too many hands in the pie the way I see it.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener, I think there was a question in there about pharmacies joining buying groups. They can and they do. And it makes a world of difference in what their acquisition costs are, whether they have joined an effective buying group or not.
Well, except we're not talking about the $4 prescriptions here. I mean, we're talking about ones that are hundreds of dollars in the cost of drugs. You don't get that for $4 at Walmart.
Give me a drug and I'll pull it up on Walmart, and I bet you it's going to be a lot less because they buy direct. They don't go through PBM. I will bet money they don't. I mean, for me, it's about purchasing. In my business, we go out and we look at where we can get the best product at the best price for manufacturing the parts that we make, because every little bit adds to whatever margin we put into it. Right now, I pull up the diagram and the chart, and we have way too many hands in the middle of the pie making money off of drugs. And I think we need to give pharmacists a chance to go out and...
Oh, I think... Do you belong to a purchasing group?
I do. And the PSAO is also a part of the...
Yes, it's Pharmacy right. Service...
Administrative organization. And so that's a part of the Dash 1, because as the law stands now, currently they were left out. And so in terms of, I have a contract with my PSAO, and so working with the PBM does not happen seamlessly. And so there is a way out for the PBM, so to speak, a loophole that we didn't think of back in 2013. I'd like to address just one thing in terms of cost of goods is really what we're talking about here, and purchasing at the best. To insinuate, I take offense to the fact that to insinuate that I would not have the business sense to buy at the best possible price is insulting, and what's best for my patient. And I think Representative Greenlee understands clearly that for us to be able to, when something changes, and not have a time period to be able to use what we have already paid for, is something that we need to look at here. In terms of making a profit, we're not talking about making a profit. We're talking about covering the cost of goods that we have paid for. In terms of a profit, there have been studies done on the cost to dispense. It takes an average of $12.50 to pay for the cost to dispense, for me to pay for the lights, the bottle, my insurance that I buy for my employees' salary. So to make a profit, we have a long ways to go. There are many, many, I consider myself lucky if I make 50 cents over the cost of what my invoice cost is. So again, let's be very clear when we talk about making profit versus covering the cost of goods. And that's very different also when we're comparing to other providers who are providing a service without a cost of goods.
Mr. Chair, I have one follow-up.
All right.
For CVS. Do you pay rebates?
2 minutes.
Do you pay rebates to the insurance companies or people you contract? Do you pay rebates to them, and do you pay rebates to pharmacists?
So that's a good question. There, it depends on the deal that or the contract that we have with the payer. So the payer can decide that they want to assume the rebate and they want the rebate back, but they take a bigger risk in the cost of the drugs overall. If another model for our deals with payers could be that we would take the rebate, but we also assume the risk of the cost of the drugs for the patients that we're covering. Does that answer your question?
It totally does.
Okay. Thank you.
Bueller had one.
Representative Bueller, yes, sir.
Quick question. I'm having a hard time understanding why it's not possible to quickly update and inform the pharmacies of the MAC pricing.
Can I answer that? Sorry.
Yeah.
Representative Bueller, by the law, we are required to update the MAC list every 7 days. So those are being updated every single week. In terms of updating the pharmacist, I don't know if what you're envisioning would happen, like an email alert or something, but we can be assured that they're happening weekly. So I don't know.
An email every week with an Excel spreadsheet listing the prices. Why is that so hard?
Well, the portal is available online now. Any pharmacist can log in and see what their MAC prices are right now.
Can I have a response from?
That is true for CVS, has that portal. All PBMs do not have easy access like that.
Would that be acceptable if they all had that type of option?
I think that if we, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, guys, did you have
a- So I had a question that was related to this, which last week one of the pharmacists said that there were more complaints in another part of the country, and so the cost came down. I think it was, is it the MAC list is different by region? For some reason, the cost came down, and in Oregon they were told, well, not as many people have complained in your area, so they kept the cost high. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, I don't know about that pharmacist's exact experience or why they were informed that way. The MAC lists are typically set by the payers. So if there's, you know, depending on the availability of a drug in a particular region, because that's part of the existing law, is that the drugs have to be available.
Would you repeat what you just said? That right. The MAC list is set by Cambia, not by you?
Right. Well, we offer them a set of, it's not just Cambia, it's the state, it's any payer. So we have standard MAC lists, and if a payer wants to modify that MAC list for some reason, that is within the payer's power to do so.
What's on the, you mean the, not the cost, just what drugs are there?
Correct.
Well, that is the cost.
There are multiple MAC lists available. Yes.
Tom, is that your, are you the guy that's at fault here?
You're yes out of, no. Over your skis now.
Like, I hope not.
I'm going to close this hearing.
Yeah.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2875. And failing any business before us, we are adjourned. Any business before us, we are adjourned.